You're listening to a message from Every Nation GTA. For more information, please visit our website at everynationgta.org.
All right, awesome job. Thank you so much. You can take your seat. Welcome, everyone. My name's Richard, Associate Pastor here, and it's great to have you on this Sunday morning. And if you're joining us for the first time, it's really great to have you here. Hope you can stick around for some refreshments afterwards. We're going to jump in. We're in this series called Empires and Exiles. We're working through half the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. And Daniel's, I hope, has been a very encouraging book for you, even though it's written some 2,500 plus years ago in a culture very different to ours. It has immense application to us. And so I hope that you've been getting some encouragement, some direction from that. And Daniel reads the story about how the nation of Israel was overtaken by one of the most dominant empires ever, the Babylonian Empire, in history. And they took a bunch of the Israelites into captivity, into Babylon, into a city. So they left Jerusalem, which was a very God-centric culture, kind of like you'd walk into Starbucks and, you know, Chris Tomlin would be playing. Now they're in Babylon, you go into Starbucks and Chris Tomlin is not playing. So they're in a pluralistic culture, lots of many gods. And so they're trying to figure out, how do they serve God faithfully? How do they not sell out to their beliefs and their core convictions? And at the same time, how do they not withdraw from Babylon? And a lot of reverence for us today. How do we engage in a city like Toronto? So much great things in the city of Toronto, and at the same time, we're called to be a people and a citizen of a different kingdom as well. And so we're going to jump into Daniel chapter 5 today. And so the first half of the book of Daniel is what's called narrative form. And so Daniel's recounting these stories, and probably the best way to do that is just to read the stories because they're self-contained. And so we're just going to do that. I'm going to read it. It's a relatively longest chapter, and every now and again I'll pause to just fill in some commentary that I think will be helpful. And then I'll be sure to wrap up with some application. So here we go. If you weren't here last week, so Daniel 4 and Daniel chapter 5 really tie in together. Last week we looked at King Nebuchadnezzar, and we saw that he was a king that was very proud, and God actually humiliated him in order to bring about humility into his life. And we saw that that king responded well to that, and we drew out some conclusions. We're going to look at a different king now. This is happening some 25 plus years after King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar is now laid to rest. Daniel is an old man. He's perhaps in his late 80s now. They've been in Babylon for almost 70 years, which for some of you know that that's coming the end towards the end of their time there. And there's a new king on the scene, and we're going to hear all about him and his dealings and how God deals with him and his pride and see his outcome. So join me in Daniel chapter 5, verse 1. We're going to read a couple of verses together, and then, as I said, we'll do some running commentary and then draw out some application. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So it's setting the scene for us. I mean, here's a party. Here's a party on a big scale. I mean, they could throw some pretty raucous parties in those times. And Belshazzar, so here's a couple of things. This is sometimes where the Bible can be a bit funny. It says King Nebuchadnezzar's father. It's not his literal father. So that word could be probably better translated a predecessor, your ancestor. Belshazzar's father was King Nabonidus. Now, if you're a history buff, you'll know that the last king of Babylon was a King Nabonidus. So why do we have King Belshazzar? And this was a lot of consternation for a lot of historians who felt like Daniel was historically inaccurate. And in the last 50 to 100 years, they discovered some what's called as the Nabonidus Chronicles. They begin to tell about some of his offspring, his kids, his children. So King Nabonidus was the official king of Babylon, the Babylonian Empire at this time. But he was away a lot from the city of Babylon. And so Belshazzar, his son, was kind of like a co-regent, a vice-regent in his place, in his stead. He was reigning, and so was legitimately had the highest authority in his father's absence. And we also kind of see a little bit of Belshazzar's heart, right? I mean, this is a guy who likes to party. He's got a lot of wives, got a lot of women, a lot of drink. And generally, when those two go together, probably not the best way to live your life. You know, kind of a rock and roll lifestyle. And even more devastating, and this is part of his big the judgment that's coming to him, is he decides that he's so proud that he's going to take these holy vessels that were taken out of the temple in Jerusalem when they were overtaken some 70 plus years ago. And he's going to use those to continue in his revelry and dedicate them to his gods, gods of gold and silver and iron. And so it's painting the picture of the character of this king. And so we're going to continue verse 5 and see what happens. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. I mean, there's nothing like a disembodied hand to kind of ruin a party, right? It's like, whoa, what's going on there? Anyways, and the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, his knees knocked together. In other words, he was terrified. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, the astrologers, his wise men. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. A third ruler because his dad was king, he was kind of second, and so he could then offer the third place. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. So we're seeing, if you've been in the series any length of time with us, we're seeing a similar pattern. These kings have some crisis. They call in their wise men, their magicians, their astrologers, and for whatever reason, they can't make sense of it. Except one guy in this kingdom, and his name is Daniel. He has a special gift from God, not the gods of the Babylonians at least. And so we're going to see how once again the Babylonian wise men fail, but there is one who doesn't. So let's continue. Daniel is remembered. The queen. Now again, it's not his wife. It's probably more the queen mother. So it could be his mom or even his grandmother. Because of the words of the king and his lords came into the banqueting hall. And the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father or your ancestor, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers. Because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. So again, we're seeing a similar pattern. We're looking for this Daniel. Now, just a little interesting side note. This is the only time that we see a woman speak in the book of Daniel, and I think she represents pretty well. In the midst of debauchery, she brings some clarity and some wisdom. So go, ladies. Sisters doing it for themselves. Let's continue. Daniel comes before this king. The Daniel was brought in before the king. Now, again, if you were here last week, notice how his response to King Nebuchadnezzar last week is so very different to his response to this king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah." So a little bit of contempt for him. You're one of those exiles. Never mind that Daniel at this stage is probably very well respected in this kingdom. He had gotten the previous king out of lots of interesting situations. So no doubt Daniel has a well-esteemed reputation. And yet this king doesn't seem to bring that up or bring the honor that at least. I've heard that view that the spirits of the gods in you and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I've heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck. I mean, I just think of hip-hop like Daniel Dre, like, what's up, man? You can represent the West Coast in my kingdom. And so, anyway, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and you shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. And then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. I'm not interested in your gifts. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. He's very short. Last week, we saw a side of Daniel that obviously loved and had developed a relationship with that king, Nebuchadnezzar. And so even when he brought Nebuchadnezzar a really hard word, he brought in a real spirit of respect. Very different with this king. He's very short. He's ready to give the interpretation. And so let's hear what he has to say. So he's going to kind of summarize for Belshazzar some history here. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. I mean, those are godlike distinctions. And Nebuchadnezzar was given that by the God of gods. But when King Nebuchadnezzar's heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened, so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne. That was last week. And his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast. And his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dews of heaven until, and this is what we saw last week, the purpose that God does is not God's sadistic or like, hey, let me see if I can mess with somebody's mind. And, you know, literally this king was driven away, you know, and fed like he thought he was a cow, and like he just went mad. And we saw that picture, the painting last week. But this is the point. This is what God's trying to do with the king, and not just the king, with mankind, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. King Nebuchadnezzar began to think and forgotten his place in relation to God. So let's go. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath. I think it's a beautiful play on words because a hand was right in general. The God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways. You have not honored. So his judgment is pronounced on him. You say, okay, why? Why was King Nebuchadnezzar given maybe a little bit more leeway? And this king, it seems like it's just very short. Well, part of it is this, is that Belshazzar, you knew, you saw, you heard the stories of what your king, the king previous to you, went through. You saw how pride engulfed his life and what God did to humble him and then how he responded. And yet, knowing all this, you have gone and set about doing exact same things, even worse things. You've set yourself up against God. You've taken that which belongs to him, that which is holy to him, and shown contempt for it and used it for your debauched parties. You've lifted up your worship, your praise to gods of gold, straw, wood that can't even hear, see, or know, that they're useless gods. And yet the very God who holds your breath, you have failed to humble yourself before him. And so here comes the interpretation. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, mene, tekel, and parson. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Those words were Aramaic words for descending weights. And so Daniel brings this interpretation and said, basically, the writing's on the wall for you. So that this is where we get the common day phrase, the writing's on the wall, which basically means like the writing's on the wall, pretty clear and evident what's about to happen. And it's pretty much nothing you can do about it. There's a judgment coming. And history will tell us that, in fact, the Medes and Persians did overthrow the Babylonian Empire. And so we see this amazing empire come crashing down. So what's the result? Then Belshazzar gave the command. Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck. What's up, Daniel? And a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And so there begins the Medo-Persian empire. And so there's a couple of things in this. It sounds very swift, but here's the reality. And this, again, what history helps fill in some of these blanks as well, is the Medes and Persians had basically encamped Babylon for some time. And so part of the party, part of the idolatrous feast and party that he's having, makes no sense. Either he underestimated the strength of the surrounding army, put too much confidence. Babylon was a very well-fortified city. I mean, let's make no mistake. But he knew that there was an impending army about to overtake it. Either he underestimated that, or he knew about it and just didn't care. And so this king has put his confidence and his trust in all the wrong places. And at a time when he should have been defending his city and his people, he's throwing a wild party. So once again, we ask these questions. These are great. These are great little narratives from history. How does that apply to me in 21st century Toronto? And so let's do the work of that. Let's say, okay, well, why was Daniel writing this? And then what can that help us today? And so again, the first thing here, it's nothing new. It's the theme of Daniel. It's that God reigns. And you might be sounding like, okay, give us something new. Well, I'd love to give you something new, but this is exactly why Daniel's reminding his people particularly and us generally, is that God reigns. Because despite appearances, you know, sometimes it can look like God isn't reigning, right? If you're an Israelite in Babylon, you've been there for some 70 years, you've seen your parents' generation die out, you might think that God's abandoned you. Yes, we've had glimpses of his miraculous workings through Daniel and his three friends, but by and large, they're far from home. They're exiles. They long to be not in Babylon. They long to be back at home in Jerusalem, where they can go to the temple and worship their gods. And so sometimes it can be disheartening and discouraging, even for you and I. As we look, we live in a globalized world, which more so gets us in touch with how unstable the world really is. We're in touch of what things are happening on the other side of the world, what's happening in Asia and how they may potentially impact us. We live in such a volatile time. We're on the brink of a perhaps nuclear world war. Who knows? And so for many, it can be very disconcerting. It can feel like things might be out of control. It could perhaps even feel like, God, where are you? But let's even bring it down to your personal life. Aren't we all in a position sometimes where it feels like, God, what are you doing? Where are you in my life? Do you not care? Have you exiled me and abandoned me? And so what I think Daniel's saying is not just God reigns, our response should be to take heart. That God is not weak. The Babylonian gods are not something so stronger than him. God is all powerful. God's so powerful that he could humble the most powerful man in his kingdom on the earth in one go. And in this night, he tears down a kingdom and raises up another empire. That all of this is in his plan, and that's sometimes hard. Like, why would God use evil empires? But it's all part of his plan. And that should encourage you in your life. And so even right now, something that you can do practically this, is there a part of your life, some aspect of your life, probably more, but maybe this one part of your life, what would it look like for you to remember that God's in control, not just of empires and nations and history, but your personal life? Is it a relationship, or is it financial strain, or is it something else that you feel is perhaps out of control? What would it look like for you to remember that God's sovereign, God's at work, sometimes beyond what appearances may look like? And I encourage you to do that. In the Old Testament times, surrounding nations, when they saw Israel's defeat, they often saw that as evidence that their gods were stronger and more powerful than the nation of Israel's God, than Yahweh's God. But the writers of the Old Testament are very clear. The nation of Israel is never at the mercy of foreign gods. They're always at the mercy of Yahweh. Because the foreign gods don't exist. They're non-entities. They're idols of that can't hear or see or speak. They're powerless in the face of God. There is nothing beyond God's purpose. There's no way that God's purpose can be thwarted, can be stopped. And so for us to remember that is for us then to have courage and to take heart in what we see here today. Because there's plenty to be discouraged by. You know, if you think about how appearances are not all that should be, for certainly in Babylonian times, it appeared that God was powerless in the face of these Babylonian gods. What about the cross? You think about the ultimate scenario of where it just seems God's absence. I mean, this Jesus, this Messiah, this one who's going to bring in and usher in the kingdom. For hundreds of years, we've been waiting for this promised Messiah. Here he is, performing signs and miracles and wonders, all the fulfillment of our prophets. This is our moment. Rome, the empire that was reigning at that time of Jesus, when he came into history, they were an oppressive and cruel government. And so now we as the people of God are going to be liberated. And what does their leader do? He goes and dies on a cross. In fact, the Roman Empire put him on a cross and did what they did best. They crucified insurgents, people who rose up and got too popular. And so once again, isn't it that the empires of this world have just crushed God? But don't we understand the cross to be something very different, right? Looking back, it was the greatest victory God could ever have. And so let the cross remind you that it doesn't matter what appearance, what things look like in your life right now, God is able to turn even the most hopeless situation in your life into a situation for his glory and your ultimate good. So take heart. God reigns over nations, over history, and over your life. The question for you and me is, are we submitted to that reign? Have we allowed that reign to engulf us? Have we come under that reign, that realm and that reign? What does it look like to bring all aspects of your life under the rule and the reign of God? And it's important because the second thing I think Daniel tells us is not only does God reign, but God resists. Excuse me. God resists. And so the implication for us, well, if God resists, what does God resist? James 4 verse 6 tells us God opposes or resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Belshazzar is a picture, it's a vivid picture of the human condition that rejects God. It's a picture of the condition of pride, of idolatry, of sacrilege. Those three usually always work together. What are they? Pride. Pride, in essence, is us elevating ourselves to a God-given place. Last week, we looked at this. It said, pride creates the illusion that we are competent to run our own lives, achieve our own sense of self-worth, and find a purpose big enough to give us meaning in life without God. That's what pride does. It edges God out of our lives. It raises us up. That's what these kings were doing. That are failing to acknowledge God in their lives. Idolatry, you know, it's to put something or someone in place of God in our lives, to trust in that thing and look to it in a way that we should only look to God, that we build our lives and identity on that thing. And no thing is made to endure that. It will crush us. There's a God place in each of our lives that only God can occupy. Anything we put there that's not God is eventually too small. It's too small. It can't fulfill or occupy what only God can. And so pride, what does pride look like for your life, for my life? Well, how do you make decisions? Do you make decisions based on information, which is not a bad thing? Please make decisions based on information and facts. But where does God enter into your decision making? You know, I'm not talking about what shirt you should wear today, what socks you should wear. But the things like, where should you go and study? Where should you work? What career should you pursue? Who should you marry? Where should you live in the city? Does God ever enter? You know, if God is on the move in Canada, do you ever ask the question, God, where are you at work and how can I join you in what you're doing? As opposed to, where does my work take me and how can God, you join me in that? Tough question, right? Hard question because, you know, these things are very much tied to our lives. But if we think of pride as these kings and it doesn't affect me and pride's just something, I mean, of course they're going to be proud. They had anything and everything and at the click of a finger could have anything. I struggle in my life. Well, anxiety and worry is a form of pride. It's a form of us trying to control our lives or feeling like our lives are out of control. Well, what about God being in control of life? What does that look like? When we decide what's right and wrong, it's a mass form of pride. It's a big thing in this day and age, right? Not just among non-Christians, but among Christians, deciding what's right and what's wrong. And so we got to be careful. And in sacrilege, what does sacrilege mean? It means to misuse or abuse things that are supposed to be sacred, that are set aside for God. And the human condition does that. You're sacred. You're made in the image of God. But outside of God, what the human condition does is we misuse and abuse the things that God's given to us for His glory and His pleasure. Your bodies. We misuse and abuse, or people misuse and abuse. I mean, what are we seeing right now with all these amazingly horrific revelations coming out of Hollywood and places of abuse of power? Well, part of it is just seeing women or people as objects. So we've misused and treated the human being sacrilege. It's sacred. It should be honored and esteemed. But the human heart, without Jesus intervening, is going to treat things with sacrilege. What about power? What about comfort? Anything outside of having Jesus as Lord of our lives, we're going to treat and misuse. And so what's the antidote? The antidote is to humble yourself. What does that mean? It's to have the right view of yourself in relation to God. It's to have the right view of yourself in relation to God. It's not to say I'm nothing, I'm worthless, because that's not true either. Gosh, does the cross not show how much you are worth? How valuable you are to God? That's false humility to make yourself less. It's humility is to just see yourself in view of who God is. So if you've got a lot of power, if you've got a lot of authority, awesome, use it. Don't step away from it, but see it as a God-given gift, and that God will call you to account for how you use that to advance His purposes, to serve people, or to treat or mistreat people. And then lastly, we've got to move along here. Last thing is God rescues. You know, the hand of writing on that wall, the hand that was writing judgment of that wall, some 600 years later would be the hand that would be nailed to a cross taking that very judgment. And so this is an amazing, amazing aspect of the God of Christianity, is He pronounces judgment on sin. He's not easy on the things that displease Him. It's not like He's like, oh, you guys, you humankind, you're all the same, but I'm going to just persevere because I'm a God of love. Come, let me give you a big teddy hug and, you know, that sin thing. We'll just overlook that, you know. You know, it's 21st century. He doesn't do that. You wouldn't want a God that would just say, oh, your abuse, let's just overlook that. You know, it's their psychological conditioning. They couldn't help themselves. You would not want that, right? And justice cries out. Well, the good news is we have a God who's all about justice. But He doesn't pour it out into you and I that we deserved. He put it out into Himself. And so that hand of judgment that writes, that hand took a nail and was nailed to a cross, that God rescues people out of their idolatry, pride, sacrilege, sinful ways, so that they could live the life that He intended to live. And so what should our response be? Well, firstly, it should be that you receive that if you haven't, if you're not a recipient of that rescuing. But I think for us is to join Him in that. That we'd be a community that extends that rescue to people. That we have a heart to see that rescue go out. That we have a healthy view of God. That God's not just some mean old grandfather who just wants to zap people. But that God is a God of justice and a God of love. And the cross, again, is a beautiful picture of how He brings that together. I want to end with the words in Philippians out of the Message Bible to drive this through. Let's invite the band up so we can bring the service to wrap. The Message, Philippians 2, verse 7 to 11, speaking of Jesus, speaking of how Jesus. Now look, if there was a king who could boast, if there was a king who could be proud, if there was a king above all kings, it was Jesus. And let's look at how He used His position. When the time came, Jesus, he set aside the privileges of deity and took on the status of a slave, became human. Having become human, he stayed human. It was an incredibly humbling process. He didn't claim special privileges. Instead, he lived a selfless, obedient life and then died a selfless, obedient death. And the worst kind of death at that, a crucifixion. Because of that obedience, God lifted him high and honored him far beyond anyone or anything ever, so that all created beings in heaven and on earth, even those long ago dead and buried, will bow and worship before this Jesus Christ and call out in praise that he is the master of all, to the glorious honor of God the Father. This is the Jesus that we serve. This is the Jesus that laid his life down for us. And this is the Jesus that must rescue you and me so that we can fulfill and join God and his mission. I'm going to invite us to stand. I'm going to pray. I don't know if we have a time for a song. I'll leave that to you, Bert, but I'm going to pray and then hand it back to Bert to close out the service for us. Father, we don't want to be like Belshazzar, who didn't seem to learn the lessons that you presented from other kings. God, in our own lives, we know enough to know to that, Lord, that we can either choose to humble ourselves or be humbled by you, that we can avoid the school of humiliation by learning lessons of humbling. And part of that humbling is to look at the cross, is to look at what you, Jesus, have done, and how you gave up your glory and became like one of us, so that through your perfect life and death, that we could become like you. And so, God, we're wrecked by that. We want ask you to rescue us from our pride, from our idolatry, from our sacrilege. God, we ask you that you would help us to help others, Lord, to turn to you and to see you for who you are, God, the goodness of who you are, your justice. When a world cries out against injustice, that we would see a God that executes justice perfectly and lovingly for your glory and our joy, in Jesus' name.
You've been listening to a message from Every Nation GTA. Thanks for joining us. For more information, visit our website at everynationgta.org.